Welcome to Look Ahead Radio and Viewpoints Around the World. My name is Tom Arms, and in a moment I'll be joined by my old friend Lockwood Phillips. We'll be discussing a number of world affairs, such as Jerusalem, the Mueller investigation, and the latest on Brexit. I hope you enjoy.
Welcome to Look Ahead Radio with Tom Arms and Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio joining us this afternoon. Just to remind folks as they listen to the program, it has been pre-recorded to accommodate, well, the sleeping schedule for Tom. It is nearly, well, it's 11 p.m. as this program begins on air. So with that, I'm going to say to you, good evening, Tom. And how are things in London?
Cold, dreary, wet. Grey skies, winter. Someone once wrote, you know, that London in the wintertime, the biggest problem is that the sky is no more than 10 feet above your head, which is exactly how it feels, like it's sort of lowering down right on top of you.
Well, that also has to do with a lot with the perception of the London fog or London smog, whichever you wish to call it. Does it not?
No, it's not that. I mean, certainly the London smog has gotten worse in recent years as more cars have gone to the roads, and they do have a problem now with air quality, but it's nowhere near what it was in the early 20th century or the late 19th century when it was coal fires. The cold air was pushing down the smoke from the chimneys into the streets, and you literally couldn't see your hand in front of your face. We don't have that anymore, but, you know, it just... dreary.
I can appreciate that. And it's going to get cold here. We've got the Siberian Express coming our way. Let's talk with about one item that I saw on the news that broke late yesterday and early this morning, and a name that a lot of folks may not be aware of, Christine Keeler. And was it James Perfumo?
The Perfumo affair.
Perfumo affair.
He was the war minister. Minister of War, before they had a Minister of Defense here, it was 1963, and he was sleeping with Christine Keeler. At the same time, Christine Keeler was sleeping with the naval attaché at the Soviet embassy.
Right.
And now, a lot of people said, whoa, wait a minute, when this sort of leaked out a bit. We can't have this sort of thing, you know, pillow talk.
Right.
She'll be passing on what Perfumo mentioned, whispers in her, cute little ear, or shell-like, onto the Soviets. And so questions were asked in the House of Commons, and Perfumo stood up and said, "This is outrageous. The relationship I have with Christine Keeler is entirely proper. There's no impropriety involved."
Right.
In short, he lied.
Right. And of course, it brought down... not only Perfumo and his activities, and he was definitely a rising star within, as I recall, the political environment there in the United Kingdom. But Harold Macmillan, I think, was the prime minister at the time.
Yes, they had an election a year later, and Labour won it. And probably a deciding factor was the Perfumo affair.
Right.
You know, I think the real importance of the Perfumo affair was it was one of those first examples, post-war examples, of how they pull back the curtain on the establishment. There was a lot of trust up until the 1960s, the mid-60s, by the voters in the establishment. You know, let's let them get on with things. You know, they won the war. They, to a certain degree, won the peace. You know, we've got to trust them. And then Perfumo came along. It was really the first example of this is what happens when you trust them. They lie to you.
Well, the other
nobody was reporting what Kennedy was doing in his spare time in his bedroom.
That's absolutely right. And I think that's a very good observation on your part, Tom. We're talking about, by the way, for those who are just joining us, with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. He, an expat living in London, and we're just chatting about the international affairs of the day. And we're brought up the topic very quickly about Christine Keeler.
Affairs of the past.
Affairs of the past. And she died, I guess, early this week, maybe yesterday. And it's of note, she's the last of the many players in this particular, I will call this a scandal. As a matter of fact, it was called the scandal. And you make a very good point that suddenly there was disclosures there, politics, power, sex. And you mentioned, of course, the Kennedys taking place at the same time. Not much of a mention there in that regard. But it is interesting timing on this one, Tom, as we wrap it up with this topic and go on to other issues. In light of the disclosures in the United States and, of course, similar disclosures there in Congress, we're talking about the entertainment community, Harvey Weinstein, but now also disclosures and accusations there in Parliament as well. The whole topic of power, politics, and sex is an old story for all intents and purposes. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, certainly. It's an old story. But as I said, you know, people, you know, Christine Keeler sort of drew back the curtain, was one of the first to do it.
Yeah.
And I think up until then, for a period of years, we were very much more respectful of the establishment figures.
Right.
And I think that was the beginning of the end.
Well, let's carry that forward to the United States and the issue of, if you will, respectful to authority figures, but also the issue of trust. And let's find out what has been the coverage of the continuing investigation by Robert Mueller, the special investigator. What are we hearing? What's happening in Europe? How is it being covered?
Well, as everyone says now in the European press, that the it's a sort of prima facie case for obstruction of justice. The Guardian, I think it was, that had a mathematical formula. And the mathematical formula said, Flynn pleads guilty. Trump asked Comey not to look into the Flynn case. Trump, therefore, guilty of obstruction.
No, it's interesting. He
simple did, mathematical equation.
Well, you know, it's interesting because he did not ask Comey not to look into it. As a matter of fact, Comey was well into the inspection of it. That's when he was the FBI director. The argument is, did President Trump insist that he drop the case, which the president declined, has declared, no, he did not. There is every indication that he did express concern about the speed of the investigation and hoping that it would move quicker. But in the midst of it all, there's no justification for that kind of explanation. And you said which press was describing that?
That was The Guardian. But it's also been reported pretty much the same everywhere. BBC, correspondent Anthony Zerker said something very similar.
You know,
this comes
from
the Times, in Germany.
You're,
it's all being reported more or less along those lines. Now, it's all alleged, and certainly it would need to be hashed out. But I think they are arguing at this stage that there's a very strong prima facie case for Trump to answer.
The answer to that, of course, many here in the States, and I'm a little stunned by the conclusions of the so-called mainstream media there in Europe, because there's every indication that they're very very much off target. Now, there are some concerns and issues. We won't belabor this today, but that is fascinating, what you're telling us. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this afternoon. Tom, I want to move very quickly to the issue of staying with President Trump, and we're going to get into other topics. His tweets, and you've got a note here, his special relationship. How are they being discussed there in Europe?
Everyone. I mean, we're talking about the tweet about Britain First, and Britain First is probably a terrorist organization on the far right, very close to it. They've attacked mosques. They've attacked Muslims in the street, you know, things like that. I don't think they've killed anyone, but they've certainly incited racial hatred, and they have been responsible for attacks on Islamic property. Since the presidential retweet of a false or fake news video produced by Britain First, they have taken on something like 60 new members.
Really?
Per minute.
Wow.
Or per hour.
I'll tell you what. And I
one every minute.
Okay. I want to hear about that in just a moment. And I hear your phone ringing in the background. We're going to fix that. We've got Tom Arms joining us, Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com, Look Ahead Radio. And I just want to remind you about this as we go prepare to go to a break, that you can subscribe to his regular blog and emails at LookAheadNews.com. It's not expensive. LookAheadNews.com. And of course, listen to his program, Look Ahead Radio, heard on this station and stations around the country. Around the world. You're listening to Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
This is Tom Arms with the expanded world analysis from LookAheadNews.com for the week beginning the 11th of December. LookAhead broadcasts tomorrow's news today so that you can plan to participate. Brexit, and more Brexit next week as another crunch deadline looms. Prime Minister Theresa May will be desperately trying to break the deadlock within her government. Parliament will decide on the EU withdrawal bill on Tuesday and Wednesday. Diplomats will gather in Brussels on Monday to negotiate details. Foreign ministers will meet on Tuesday for adjustments, and then on Friday, the heads of government will issue the final approval needed for talks to move on to the next stage. It will be close. It will be exciting, and it may fall apart. Other EU business includes a breakfast meeting on Monday with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The main topics will be Iran, Hezbollah, and Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as the Israeli capital. The Jerusalem issue has sparked off an emergency meeting in Istanbul on Wednesday of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The Jordanian Prime Minister said any attempts to unilaterally decide Jerusalem's fate are null and void. Meanwhile, South Korean President Moon is off to Beijing on Wednesday for talks with President Xi Jinping. His visit follows Pyongyang's most successful ballistic missile test, the largest ever U.S.-South Korean aerial military exercise, and a U.N. diplomatic mission to North Korea. In France, President Emmanuel Macron will host a climate summit on Tuesday to move forward the Paris Climate Change Agreement. 100 heads of government have been invited. Pointedly not invited is President Donald Trump. In Alabama, voters go to the polls to elect a new senator in a big electoral test for President Trump. He has endorsed the far-right evangelical Republican Judge Roy Moore, who has been accused of sexual harassment. There are several committee meetings in the U.S. Senate next week. They include a discussion of the affordability of prescription drugs and protecting American farmers in the age of globalization. In Russia, President Vladimir Putin gives his annual press conference on Thursday. The main focus will be on Putin's decision to run for a fourth term as president next spring. Kenyan opposition leader Raila Odinga on Monday stages an alternative swearing-in ceremony in protest against what his supporters have condemned as the illegitimate election of President Uhuru Kenyatta. Meanwhile, South Africa's ruling ANC holds its conference from Saturday to elect a new president to replace beleaguered Jacob Zuma. The two candidates are currently Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa and Zuma's favorite, his ex-wife. Chile holds a second round of a presidential election on Sunday. The two candidates in the runoff poll are billionaire conservative Sebastián Piñera and center-left candidate Alejandro Guillén. And that was next week's news today so that you can plan to participate in the world around you. Stay tuned for Viewpoints Around the World with myself and Lockwood Phillips.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. We're chatting with Tom about President Trump's tweets. Of particular note is a tweet related to an organization called Britain First. And Tom, you said since that, and basically it was a retweet. It wasn't, he just, passed it along. I guess it was perceived because he passed it along as
if
maybe an endorsement.
If you retweet something, you support it.
You endorse it, yeah. But what?
Yep, you endorse it.
And what has been the impact of that retweeting?
Since he retweeted it, Britain First has been getting 60 new members every hour, once a minute, since they retweeted it.
Really?
Yep.
He's
amplified their voice. Well, he's done. Every political figure, every single political figure in the country has attacked him for retweeting it. Even Nigel Farage, you know, Theresa May, everyone down except for the Queen, because she's not allowed to. Everyone from Theresa May down has attacked him for retweeting it. People, Americans get stopped in the street and are being asked by strangers who pick up their accent, what is he doing saying things like that? Why is he attacking our relationship with him? And now the question is, you know, does the United States and the UK, do they really have a special relationship? And yes, they do. They have a special relationship based on history, culture, language, things like that. There's a deep roots which will always be there.
How is that perceived as being an attack on the United Kingdom? He just retweeted something, and frankly, I've not even paid attention to the you call it fake news. It was a video that was produced by this organization, Britain First. It's really more of a sales piece. And the other aspect of this, it is fascinating that it has generated such support from the general population. Why
no,
is
it's
that?
It's not fascinating. It hasn't from the general population. From a very small percentage of the far right, it has generated support. You know, that's where it's generated the support from, the far right. And the fact is that with social media these days, if you make enough noise, because it's global in its spread, you will get people phoning in. That's the way it works. And 1% of 7 billion people is only 1%, but it's a lot. You know, it's what, 700 million or so, 70 million people,
right?
Potentially. But it's only 1%.
What impact
first,
is this?
There's no doubt that it was fake news. I'm not going to go into the argument about that. It's been exposed as totally fake.
Oh, wait, no, I understand. It was a promo piece. I mean, my goodness.
A promo piece saying what Muslim immigrants in Europe were doing.
Okay.
And most of it was filmed in the Middle East. That's what I mean by it was fake news.
All right. Now, my quick question for you is, obviously, frustrated Prime Minister Theresa May, what has been the outcry from the, you know, from the political leaders in Great Britain? Has this in any way strengthened their relationship?
They called for Trump to be banned from visiting the UK.
Okay.
One person said he should be arrested if he steps off the plane for inciting violence hatred, which is against the law here.
Okay. I find this describing this as inciting violence. Has there been any violent reaction?
No, there has been no violent reaction. But Britain First is not yet a proscribed organization, but their membership and their leadership has spent time in inciting violence and actually attacking people.
We're going to continue on with what's happening in the United Kingdom here with Tom Arms.
They're so right-wing. They were thrown out of the British National Party and refused membership of UKIP.
Let's continue on with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. The issue of Brexit, what's the future there? And I've been seeing some stories that Prime Minister Theresa May be in deeper trouble. Apparently, the policies are not moving very smoothly. What's happening?
Well, it's like I was saying last week and the week before that. The problem is Ireland. It's as simple as that. She is in coalition with a party called the Democratic Unionist Party, which is a Protestant party very much opposed to close relationship between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. They very much want to remain part of the United Kingdom. Southern Ireland always has said that they want the two sections of Ireland to be united as one country. The British have always said that it's up to the people in Northern Ireland to decide. What will happen, what was proposed in the agreement which was hammered out between Theresa May and the EU, was that there should be a mutual realignment of customs and border controls between the EU or between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland to reflect Southern Ireland's membership of the EU. And that basically means that there would be an open border between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. Well, this could lead to political unification. And so the Democratic Unionist Party said, no, we will not support this. And because Theresa May needs their votes, 10 members of parliament are from the DUP, because she needs their votes, she can't do anything without their support. Now, the final straw of this is that Scotland, Wales, and London have said, well, if you're going to have a special relationship, trading relationship for Northern Ireland, what about us? We need it too. And we all voted to remain.
Is he, in essence, creating a division? Is this creating a division within the United Kingdom, particularly in the big island there, England?
Yes.
What is the political fallout from this? Is there a possibility that Ms. May might find herself in another election?
I think there's a possibility. But things are so fluid, Lockwood, from day to day, that you really can't tell. I mean, another thing that came up the other week was they published a report analyzing the impact of Brexit on different sectors of the economy. And it was heavily criticized by the MPs who were reading it. And what they decided to do was they were going to produce this report. They were going to then give it to key members of parliament to read, who would then go through it and cross out the bits which they didn't think the public should know about because it would endanger negotiations. And so they handed this over, and the MPs looked at it and said, there's nothing here. You know, you've already edited it. We have nothing more to edit. And the government scratched their head and finally yesterday admitted the reason there was nothing else in there was because they didn't know. They didn't know how to proceed. They didn't have any alternatives. It wasn't that they edited things out. They just never had them to put in.
Well, you know, this sadly is an indication of the bad structure of the whole European Union when you don't even have, if you will, the accommodation.
No, it's not the EU. It's the UK. The UK, the Brexiteers, never had any plan beyond the referendum vote.
But the problem you have is the European Union itself doesn't have, it strikes me, and we won't belabor this because we got to go to a break, doesn't have much of a structure for addition, subtraction, or alterations in many regards.
Why should they? I mean, they didn't want Britain to leave.
Well,
it's Britain who wants to leave, and so it's their obligation to come up with the plan.
Okay. We'll discuss this a little later on. We've got Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us this afternoon. Viewpoints around the world.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment. Now return to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Joining us from London this evening, he is now at this time, it's earlier in the evening for him, as we go to a live production of this. It's pre-recorded because he is going to be asleep as we air this live on the program here on Viewpoints. But Viewpoints Around the World, every Wednesday afternoon with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio with us. Tom, a topic that's going to generate a lot of conversation this afternoon between you and me is the issue of Jerusalem and the impacts of U.S. recognition of Jerusalem. Of course, that is very hot and heavy in the news. And I'd also like to bring up a few other items associated with it, the relationships with Turkey and Russia, and because Turkey's part of this whole discussion as well. How is that story related to the president's decision or recommendations for moving the diplomatic center and to Jerusalem and recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel?
Well, there is one country that supports this, and only one in the entire world that I can see so far, and that is Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else is against it. And the reason is because successive U.S. administrations and governments around the world, ever since the founding of the state, ever since the 1967 war, have said that the final solution to the Jerusalem problem cannot be resolved except as part of an overall solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. That it is so key to the conflict that if you try to make a unilateral decision about it before, it will torpedo everything else. And that is what basically everyone is saying. The United States has always been regarded as a key broker in any solution. But the Palestinians and the Turks and a lot of other people saying, well, how can they be an honest broker if they're doing what they're doing about Jerusalem? You know, it just doesn't go together. And so it's taking America out of the Arab-Israeli conflict in the role of honest broker. So I can't understand it myself. There is nobody who supports it other than Trump.
All right, what is the reaction?
And Israel.
What is the reaction? What have you heard and seen in the press there in the United Kingdom or European communities on the continent?
Everyone's opposed to it.
Really?
Every single country is opposed to it. And I don't just mean in the EU. I mean everywhere. Russia, the Chinese, everyone is opposed to it.
You know, the issue of the U.S. being, quote, an honest broker, in light of the experiences in Iran, Iraq, the fact that the U.S. has stepped into the Middle East and has been more than just a broker, has been an active participant, and quite frankly, concerns here even in the United States of trying to, you know, generate and create governments there, nation building, as we call it. There's some concern there. How is the U.S. considered such an honest broker, if you will, in light of the past historic events?
Because of the reality of the situation. The United States supports Israel. It has always supported Israel. It has a large Jewish lobby.
Right.
You cannot have a solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict without the United States. If the United States decidedly takes one side over the other, then it's going to damage the chances of winning or securing an agreement.
All right. Very quickly, Tom, because I'm going to move on to a few other items related to the Arab-Israeli relationship. And I want to focus on the word Arab because the Saudis have been involved in a major change in their political structure. And I'm wondering, what impact is this having on that? Because that was the topic of coverage all last week.
It's not completely clear yet, but if you want my thoughts on it, which is what you're going to get, whether you want them
obviously,
or not, is that it's going to undermine the Saudis. The Saudis have been secretly dealing with the Israelis against the enemy Iran.
Mm-hmm.
They have very close relations now with the U.S., as we know that was where Trump headed first when he became president, was off to Saudi Arabia. He supported Saudi Arabia in their diplomatic row with Qatar and continues to support them. He is providing weapons, $110 billion worth, to help them fight the Yemenis or the Houthis in Yemen. And so that's a very close ally. Now, the reason he had this counter coup problem recently, one of the reasons was because he is perceived as being too pro-American or too pro-Israeli and turning his back on the conservative religious elements in Saudi Arabia. Well, if the United States recognizes Jerusalem, it just gives ammunition to that Islamic core in Saudi Arabia, and it's going to make the crown prince's problem more difficult.
Okay. You brought up the word Yemen. Let's talk about Yemen.
Yeah. Well, we've just had somebody killed there. And that was the chap, former President Saleh. And that was the chap who was, in fact, allying himself with the Houthis.
Mm-hmm.
And he got basically chopped off because he said he wanted to have talks now with the Saudis who have been fighting the Houthis. So he had thrown in his towel. But the Houthis weren't ready to have the towel thrown in, so they got rid of him.
All right.
I think he was 77 years old, but he isn't anymore. This is going to make a solution to the Yemen problem even more difficult, and it's become another Vietnam or quagmire for the Saudis. So for the Saudis, you've got lots of problems. You've got now this problem of Jerusalem and the relations with Israel and the United States. You have the growing influence of Iran, and you have this drain on the resources, which is Yemen. And they've got to do something about Yemen. They cannot afford to have a hostile government in Yemen because it guards the southern entrance to the Red Sea. So at one end, you have the port of Aden, which is part of Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
And at the other end, you've got the Suez Canal. In between, you have Saudi Arabia and the Red Sea.
Right. I want to move very quickly to another item. What influence does this have for Iran?
Oh, it will definitely help Iran.
Okay.
I mean, you know.
All right. I just wish.
No doubt about that.
All right. Let's talk about, since we're in that part of the world, and we're going to focus on Russia for several items here. Let's talk about Russia and its missiles in Turkey. And, of course, President Erdogan has opposed the possible move of the capital to Jerusalem and the diplomatic center from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. President Erdogan, of course, has at times held hands with every international and national leader. Russian missiles in Turkey, what does this mean?
$2 billion, four batteries of what are called S-400 anti-aircraft missiles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's very interesting. These are Russian-made. It's very interesting. They put out an infographic on this, which showed them in action, you know, and listed all the planes that these are designed to shoot down. Every single one of them was either British, American, or French.
Right.
So our ally has just bought an anti-aircraft system which is designed to shoot down our planes.
Which, by the way, let me go back and think about something here, Tom Arms of Look Ahead News, Look Ahead Radio. Isn't Turkey part of NATO?
Yes. Yes, oh, it is. And NATO has said, all right, in theory, you're free to buy your missiles from wherever you want, but you've got to bear in mind, mate, that these missiles are not going to work with any equipment we produce. They can't be linked up to NATO radar, which you already use. You know, it doesn't make sense. You're only doing it for political purposes to tweak the Western nose and to move in a bit closer to Moscow.
How serious is that? And when I ask that question, I mean, President Erdogan has been known to be, very unpredictable. I'm being kind.
Nuts.
Nuts? Okay.
He's nuts sometimes. Yeah. Unpredictable is a nice way of putting it, yes.
All right. Speaking of unpredictability, let's talk about, and we're going to get into this very quickly in the after the break, United Nations representative to North Korea. I'm sorry, I connected North Korea nuts, but for a variety of reasons. What does this amount to?
Well, it's very interesting. He used to be a U.S. diplomat before he moved over to the U.N. I think you can draw whatever conclusions you want from that. I think that there are some moves to try and develop talks. He's in Pyongyang now, and he will be there till Friday. His name is Jeffrey Feltman. Apparently, at the U.N. General Assembly in September, North Korean diplomats approached the UN and said, you know, how about if you send somebody over? You know, maybe we can talk.
Is this a result
and
of the...
So the UN thought about it. They actually did go to the State Department, who did not raise any objection. And it was decided that it might be a good idea if a former American diplomat went.
Is this a result of the recent show of military force, possibly?
It's difficult to tell. It could be a result of that, or it could be a result of the launching of the missile. It could also be the result of the comment that Kim Jong-un made after he launched the missile. He did not do his normal stand up on the soapbox and wave his arms about and threaten to kill everybody in sight. Instead, he stood up and said very quietly, "We will be a responsible nuclear power." What that means in practice, you know, it might be worth investigating, and that might be why they decided to send Feltman. I'm not saying that the biggest ever aerial exercises involving South Korea and the U.S. didn't also have an effect. I'm sure they did. But it could be a combination of these things coming together. And I'm not saying there's necessarily going to be any real solution. After the missile was launched, you notice that Trump said, not that, you know, there's going to be any fire and fury, but Trump said, we are dealing with it.
Right. And by the way, we are dealing with it with, of course, the show of military force. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We've got Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Just to remind you, go online to LookAheadNews.com and subscribe, and it is not expensive. And you will be actually getting tomorrow's news today. Stay with us here on Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio will return in just a moment.
Observations of an Expat by Tom Arms from LookAheadNews.com. A long time ago, back in 1977, I was invited to Israel as a guest of the Israeli government. At the time, I was the diplomatic correspondent of a large chain of British newspapers, and, despite the Balfour Declaration, the British press was not known for a pro-Israeli stance. Their reporters seemed more attracted to the wild open spaces and the vast starlit skies of Arabia than the biblical lands. I, however, am an American, and had absorbed a pro-Israeli stance through osmosis. The Arabs were in bed with the Reds, and the plucky democratic Israelis had seen off repeated attempts to push them into the Med. When I visited, everyone was still arguing about the outcome of the 1967 war, in which the Israelis managed to secure the rest of Jerusalem and the West Bank and the Golan Heights in just 6 days. It was a triumph, and the poster of the year in America was of a weedy-looking Hasidic Jew bursting out of a phone box while tearing off his black coat to reveal a Superman costume. But 10 years later, the world was demanding that Israel withdraw to its pre-1967 borders. No, said Israel. We need defensible borders. That was the diplomatic mantra. Defensible borders. Defensible borders. I arrived in the heat of the summer, but waiting for me was an air-conditioned limousine, a driver, and a young Israeli from the foreign ministry. I was his first diplomatic assignment. After the mandatory tour of Jerusalem, we started a week-long road trip with a drive to the Lebanese border. Lots of wire and guards. We then turned south and drove along the Jordan River through the Ula Valley and the Jordan Rift Valley. It was, still is, a rich and fertile land whose kibbutz farms churned out thousands of tons of oranges every year. As we drove south towards the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, I was shown the Golan Heights that gently rose in the east, the left side of the car. On the western side of the valley, there was an almost vertical wall of mountains. You can see, explained my young diplomatic guide, why we need to occupy the Golan Heights. Before the Six-Day War, the Syrian-backed Fedayeen would just sit on the heights, lobbing mortars into the kibbutz below. Thousands of families lived under constant fear of attack and death. It was an impossible situation. We need to occupy the Golan Heights to secure defensible borders. I rolled down the window, leaned out, and studied the layout of the Golan Heights as the car sped south. I then looked around my guide and through the other window to the mountains in the west. In all innocence, I blurted out the results of my observation. Have you ever thought that the mountains might be a better defensible border than the Golan Heights? My guide's eyes opened wide, and his lower jaw dropped. I ignored him and ploughed on. Think about it, I said. You could offer to return the Golan Heights and relinquish the valleys in return for peace and the most defensible borders possible. The blood started to rise from his collar. I added, I think the international community would be astounded by such a grand gesture in search of a lasting peace. The diplomatic mask slipped. The guide exploded. He banged his fist so hard on the leather armrest divider that the driver jumped and we nearly drove off the road. We will never, he bellowed, relinquish one square millimeter of Eretz Israel. This land was given to us by God. I had encountered the intransigence of a national policy based on religion. Political consensus was not on the table. Why should it be? God was on their side. Unfortunately, the Islamic world believes just as firmly that God backs them. This makes the Arab-Israeli conflict the most intractable and difficult to resolve in the world. Donald Trump's recognition of the holy city of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel has just made it more difficult.
Welcome back to Look Ahead Radio. Here is Lockwood Phillips.
Viewpoints around the world with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Wrapping it up with you, Tom, on several topics. And we were just chatting a few moments ago about Russia and, of course, North Korea. And there is that odd little connection there as well. We have the Winter Olympics about to kick off, and that will be conducted in South Korea, absent any major military event, of course. Russia, interestingly enough, has been excluded from the Olympics, apparently because of, well, some issue with doping. So how is that being, has that been covered in the European press? And what's the opinion about that?
It was covered some time ago in the European press, not specifically, but it was known, it's been known for some time that because of the doping scandal in Russia, that they would most likely not participate in the Winter Olympics. And so this doesn't come as new news. It comes as very much expected. And so for that reason, it's been very much under the crease, under the bottom, at the bottom of the page.
You know that they have announced that they will allow Russian athletes to compete. They just will not be able to compete under the Russian flag. I'm wondering, how does Mr. Putin feel? Has he responded to this announcement, or is this really, as you just mentioned, kind of old news?
It's pretty old news. It's a reaction to the fact that, according to the Olympic investigations, the doping is very much a state-organized affair.
Oh, yes. Well, not a surprise.
Which, of course, Putin denies.
Right.
But then he denies so many things.
Right. No question. Yeah, that's one of the issues of diplomacy this day and age, the absence of transparency and integrity. All right, moving on with Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. The topic comes up, and this is an international issue, one that I'm sure is accommodated by the United Nations. Which country is best at Scrabble?
Yeah, I thought I'd simply ask you the question. Which country do you think is best at Scrabble?
I wrap myself in the flag. I'd have to say America, the United States.
Wrong. Nigeria.
Nigeria?
Nigeria. They have focused, small countries. Nigeria is not a particularly small country. But countries with not a great deal of resources, and you're seeing this increasingly, are focusing their efforts on one small area so that they can be the very best at that. Uganda now is leading Africa in chess.
That is fabulous.
Nipping at the heels of Iceland.
Which, by the way, we've known for quite some time, Iceland and Russia have been major areas for chess. But that's fascinating.
Yeah, well, Uganda, but young people in Nigeria now, they dream of becoming Scrabble champions. And in Uganda, they dream of becoming chess champions.
That is wonderful. You know what's interesting about this, Tom, and this is a personal observation, notice the absence of digital concern, but rather academic mental activities that involve, if you will, rather pedestrian, but I don't think it's pedestrian, but I'm looking for a word in that to describe it better, activities. I think that's a real credit to those countries and to those cultures.
They have government support, and that's one of the main reasons for it. Yes.
Well, I think that's fabulous. Tom Arms of LookAheadNews.com and Look Ahead Radio. Tom, as we wrap it up, remind folks about LookAheadNews.com. How can they get hold of this subscription?
Well, just go to the website, click on the subscription button, and then click on shop. It only costs $20 a year. And for that, every week you get an email, which includes this radio broadcast and some other radio broadcasts, a blog, and a USP of what is happening next week around the world. As far as I know, we're the only ones doing it. And the idea is to help people to participate more in world affairs by giving them the vital tool of advance information.
I think it's very important. And while we still look at, and I do for sure, the benefits of nationalism, I think it is still important that we become more aware of international issues and international news. All the more reason why we enjoy this program every Wednesday afternoon. Viewpoints Around the World with Tom Arms of Look Ahead News and Look Ahead Radio. And lookaheadnews.com. And you said just $20 for the entire year's subscription.
That's right.
All right. Lookaheadnews.com. Tom, as always, thank you very much and a good evening to you.
Thank you and good evening to you, Lockwood.
Viewpoints Around the World.
Look Ahead Radio is a production of The Talk Station.